the International Conference to resolve the peace issue as between Israel and Palestine.
Esta fase del ataque más criminal, obviamente, pues la acción de Hamas, pero sobre todo este.
And then, in the latest phase, which is to say, after the action by Hamas, and particularly since the genocide by Israel against the Palestinian people, he took a very clear stand. Broke relations with Israel, sought justice internationally, and has called for an immediate halt to the violence.
América Latina y el concierto internacional que han acompañado esa posición, pero
this is similar positions have been voiced in Latin America and internationally of support for these same stands, but the response really needs to be much clearer and much stronger, particularly from Europe, say Canada and the United States, where it has been too weak so far.
Partes del planeta en la cual la reacción ha sido, hay que decirlo, débil por parte de los gobiernos.
Colombian leftist Senator Iván Cepeda speaking to us from Bogota. Former Colombian President Álvaro Uribe was recently sentenced to 12 years of house arrest after he was found guilty of witness tampering and bribery. That does it for our show. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
You are tuned in to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM and streaming on the web at kboo.fm.
Our KBOO Out Loud fall membership drive is coming. Tune in August 20th, where we'll bring you testimonials, anecdotes, facts, and more, all day long to celebrate National Radio Day. KBOO, made by people like you, for people like you.
Support for KBOO comes from our members and from Nutrition Inside, presenting the Nutrition Inside Benefit Show, Saturday, August 16th from 4:30 to 8 p.m. at Ethos Music Center. The event will feature local music and refreshments and supports food justice for incarcerated individuals. More info at nutritioninside.org.
The solution to the Israel-Palestine crisis that's gone on for so many years has to be up to the people there. It can't be imposed from without. We have an expert to talk about it with a new book coming up. Stay tuned. I'm Bert Cohen, and with your help, we are keeping democracy alive.
He's not breathing.
Can you get a pulse?
Barely.
Last week on this show, we talked about a not yet visible future challenge, the crisis of billions of people facing serious food insecurity, or worse, and what the world is not doing about it. Today, the topic is right in our faces every day, and it's part of what's been going on for at least 76 years. The photos of the man-made starvation crisis in Gaza are haunting the world's conscience. And the wars in Israel-Palestine really go back even further to November 1917, when the Balfour Declaration was issued by the British government, because they owned the area, announcing its support for the establishment of a, quote, national home for the Jewish people in Palestine, which was then an Ottoman region with a small minority Jewish population. Were the people who actually lived there consulted? We know they were not. We thought, with the end of World War I, that was the end of the era of Western colonialism, when the British, French, and German empires had imagined they had a right to rule other lesser nations. But since the Nakba in 1948, the people of the occupied region have considered their lot to be an effect of European and American colonialism. Our guest today in a new book argues that peace today hinges on decisions by Israelis and Palestinians themselves. Today, Gaza has been nearly completely destroyed. There is what many are calling genocide happening before our eyes. And while the world is indeed outraged by the effect of Israel's policy in Gaza, thus far, it has little or nothing to offer beyond the outrage and condemnation. The Middle East, or West Asia, may be a better term, has seen uprising in wars too numerous to count. Today, we'll dive into what seems like a perpetual conundrum. After all these violent clashes without resolution, is there a solution? Can there ever be a solution? Our guest today writes, quote, "Despite their horrors, the events of October 7th and the war that followed have created a window of opportunity to advance new ideas and seek new solutions," end of quote. Certainly, it can't go on like this. It takes brave people to suggest a specific plan, a blueprint for actual resolution. And we have one of them, one of the brave people with us today, Michael Schaefer Omerman, who is co-author, along with Sarah Leah Whitson, of an upcoming book titled From Apartheid to Democracy, A Blueprint for Peace in Israel-Palestine. Talk about heavy lifts. In the book's preface, it says, "Rarely do we venture into positive prescriptions about how to fix problems beyond stopping abuses." The book asks, "Dare we propose or envision the structural changes and process needed to transform the status quo into rights respecting governance?" The world's superpowers certainly have a stake in this issue, but can a solution be imposed from the outside? As the preface notes, there's currently a lack of political vision to transform apartheid and occupation into something better after three decades of failed peace processes. Our guest, Michael Schaefer Omerman, is the director of Israel-Palestine at DAWN, which is Democracy for the Arab World Now. He's an expert on politics and society in the region with a focus on Israel's policies of occupation and annexation, its civil rights record, and the influence of the U.S.-Israel relationship. He's worked as an editor at the Jerusalem Post and 972 magazine. In these roles, he closely covered Israeli and Palestinian grassroots movements and civil society campaigns, legislative trends, and public opinion. He's done his research. Michael, thank you so much for being with us on Keeping Democracy Alive.
Thank you for having me.
Well, your upcoming book, From Apartheid to Democracy, A Blueprint for Peace in Israel-Palestine, takes on a truly Herculean task. Please tell us about how this book came to be and what qualifies you and your co-author where so many others have failed.
Thank you for the kind introduction. The impetus for this book was that we, you know, this is long before October 7th, and I'm sure we'll talk about everything that's happened since. But the impetus was a stasis, a sense that the world understood that a two-state solution, at least in the way it was envisioned by the Oslo process of the 90s, right, was no longer viable. Right. It was no longer possible, that it was moribund, that it was dead, that it was comatose. You know, everybody uses their own terms. And yet nobody had anything else to offer. The two-state solution is dead. Long live the two-state solution. And the problem there isn't with the solution. It's with that there was the death of Oslo meant that there was no path forward. You know, I remember writing a year ago that, you know, the Benjamin Netanyahu in Israeli elections was a positive vision of hope. Somebody saying, no, we can do things differently, and describing it. But nobody in the Israeli political spectrum has done that. And the Palestinian Authority has not done that. And the world has not done that. So what we tried to do with this book is to really create a proof of concept in order to inject vitality into a much needed conversation, which was not really happening at the time, of what can be done. What could the world's policies be today or tomorrow to move things out of the apartheid reality, out of the permanent occupation, and today out of genocide? But, you know, what could these governments be seeking, and then design their policies accordingly to reach that goal. And we came up with this plan as one answer to that.
Well, it must have taken a lot of research. I mean, you've been looking at this issue for quite a long time. But I wonder if you could tell us, please, about the process in writing this book.
Right. Well, it started about 4 years ago. I was still living in Israel, Palestine, where I lived for the better part of two decades, where I worked as a journalist. And when Sarah Lee and I started the project, I just opened up my journalist Rolodex, you know, all the people I had spoken to over the previous, you know, decade and a half, and started meeting with folks and asking them, like, where would you start? Like, if we were going to transform this reality. Mm-hmm. And it's important to remember that around that time, there was this growing, mostly academic movement to start describing the reality as a one-state reality, an undemocratic one-state reality, because Israel is the sole sovereign that exercises control over the entire territory between the river and the sea.
Yes.
And so I started asking people, what would you do? Where would you start? What would you avoid? Where do you think the conventional thinking goes wrong? And started to build a sort of conceptual idea. Now, these were, in the beginning, primarily Palestinians and Israelis who were living there. We expanded to subject matter experts from all over the world and the region, and started to put together an idea of what it would actually look like to dismantle apartheid and occupation. And then we did a lot of comparative research looking at other transitional other moments of transition, whether it be democratic transitions or post-colonial transitions, transitions in conflicted societies, to see what worked, what didn't, and not to take any wholesale ideas and just apply them as the best ones, but to see which offer viable and important and useful lessons for our case of Israel-Palestine. And yeah.
Well, that's quite a lot of work, and it seems entirely appropriate. And when is this book coming out? September, I believe.
It comes out September 30th from the University of California Press, and it's available everywhere.
And it does seem to me that the focus thus far has been documenting specific cases of abuse and have not envisioned any realistic structural changes in process needed to end the abuses, but to transform the status quo into rights respecting governance. So far, there's not been a framework for fixing the big picture. And in the preface, you say that failures are largely because of two critical errors. What are those two?
Well, I think there's far more than two, but I believe the two that we were discussing in that part of the book are, number one, the failure to include stakeholders in the actual design of what was happening, meaning this was the Oslo process, largely by necessity, began as a secret process by, you know, even unofficial sort of back channel diplomacy by secular men, for the most part, Israelis and Palestinians alike. And that does not necessarily reflect Israeli and Palestinian societies, neither of which are homogenous. It does not reflect regional differences, and it treats Israelis and Palestinians as homogenous blocks with homogenous needs. Another hugely important issue was the power imbalance, that Israel has had at the time the backing of most of the Western world, primarily the United States, but lots of others as well, and effectively could veto anything. So, you know, it's impossible to have actual negotiations when the power imbalance is so stark. Yeah. And that leads us to yet another huge problem, which is that it's impossible to, or I'm sorry, that statehood was never even on the table. That there was no defined endpoint. And so what we had was a transformation without a clear target, which actually created the situation of occupation and apartheid, which has only become more entrenched in the years since Oslo, and largely because of the process itself, because it created these new structures for control, like the Palestinian Authority, like the sort of entrenchment of separate legal systems, and there's no horizon.
That's true. Well, Israel was birthed officially in 1948 as a home for the Jewish people in Palestine, but since then has become defined as a Jewish state. Tell us, please, about what laws there are to keep it from being a level playing field for all its citizens. How can a level playing field be created? What are the obstacles which you say need to be overcome?
Well, first off, I think to fully answer this question, we need to back up a second and understand what a one-state reality means. Because it's not just about what happens within the confines of Israel proper. In Israel proper, there's about 80% Jews and 20% Palestinians, both Muslim and Christian. And those Palestinians have the right to vote, the right to citizenship, and large civil rights protections as individuals. But Israel also controls the occupied Palestinian territory, the West Bank, East Jerusalem, Gaza. And there, the non-Jewish residents, meaning the Palestinians, mm-hmm. not the settlers, do not have citizenship, cannot vote, have no way to influence the government that ultimately makes decisions that impact every aspect of their life. And so Israel likes to look at these separate regimes, but ultimately it's the same government that's overseeing them. So the one state analysis says there is one state, but it's an apartheid state, meaning Jewish Israelis experience it as democracy and Palestinians experience it as occupation and apartheid.
Yes.
Now,
go ahead.
There's so many sort of structural things that go into making this, and you know, much of the book is really understanding which of those are rotten to the core and need to be replaced or uprooted, and which can be reformed or are okay. For instance, you know, the easiest example is that the dual legal systems that I just discussed, you know, for a Palestinian and an Israeli standing on the same spot in the West Bank, which Israel controls, if they commit the same crime, they will be tried under different laws in different courts, with different rules, and it creates just this inherent fundamental inequality. The same is true with land ownership and all sorts of things. Within Israel, everything from immigration to discrimination is entrenched as well. Let me point out something else, which is that only a few years ago, Israel passed a basic law, which is quasi-constitutional amendment in the Israeli system, which said that Israel is the nation state of the Jewish people,
right,
and only the Jewish people,
right.
Meaning that to say Israel is a state of all its citizens, that it belongs to all of its citizens, is an affront to the ideological underpinnings of the state itself. And actually, in reality, in Israel, to say that, which some people do, that they advocate for a state of all its citizens, is almost treasonous. Mm. And I think that, you know, you can see that in land laws, like I said. You can see it in immigration laws, where every Jew in the world has the right to emigrate,
right,
to Israel,
mm-hmm.
and only Jews.
Mm-hmm.
And it goes down to, you know, like there's just tons of places, yeah, where the group rights of Jews are prioritized over the individual rights of Palestinians or anybody for that matter. Forgive me for forgetting the person who said this originally, but it's very poignant, which is that for Jews, Israel is a democracy, and for Palestinians, Israel is Jewish, meaning it's there's always been this tension between, yeah, whether Israel is a democratic state or a Jewish state, and everybody understands and has always understood that there is some tension there, but the fallacy is that they can be balanced in ways that that respect the rights of everybody. And that has just simply not been the case.
And for many years, we've heard that Israel is the only democracy in the region. But as you say, but it's not a democracy for Palestinians. And you say, quote, as Americans, we believe that we have a particularly great responsibility to contribute to finding a solution. Now, many American politicians have said America is the world's indispensable nation. Of course, that is hubris and has led to many disasters around the world. Talk about arrogance. Given that perspective, what makes you conclude that America has a particularly great responsibility? Why America? Why not the nations of European Union?
Oh, they all do. I mean, we write as Americans. It is the American government, and clearly the United States has been, at least in the past 50 years, one of the strongest forces that has created impunity for Israel and its crimes, both the ones that we're seeing in Gaza today, but also the ongoing crimes of occupation and apartheid. You know, without the U.S. support, without the diplomatic backing, without the military support, without the financial support, Israel would simply not be viable, and certainly wouldn't be immune to the types of pressures that one would expect to come in response to these types of crimes and policies and behaviors.
And of course, the power of AIPAC in our Congress is quite remarkable. And boy, they give a lot of money to be able to control American candidates. If you just tuned in, Bert Cohen here. The show is Keeping Democracy Alive. We're taking on a very difficult issue with a blueprint for a real solution. Our guest today is Michael Schaefer Omer Mann. And the new book is From Apartheid to Democracy, A Blueprint for Peace in Israel-Palestine. I remember in recent years, there was talk of Israel going back to the pre-1967 Seven-Day War lines. Are those armistice lines that were drawn up in 1949, is that still a framework that can be built on?
Those are effectively what most of the world view as the border between Israel and Palestine. Now, the problem here is Israel has never accepted those borders. If you go into Israeli schools or, you know, government buildings, or anywhere you see a map, there's no designation of that border. And because there is no state on the other side that Israel recognizes, there's never been an acknowledgement of those borders. Now, further than that, many Israelis, particularly those in power today, view Israel as the entire territory, and actually even more. And most Palestinians view Palestine as the entire territory.
Yeah.
So, you know, this is one of the reasons we choose to describe it, to give it the name Israel-Palestine in our writing.
Right.
Because, you know, it, in many ways, it's the same place. And what we're talking about, and something that, you know, some visions for the future, like Confederation, really try and grapple with, is how you can, you know, expand the pie so that it can be both things for both people while still maintaining autonomy or self-determination in a more national and less individualistic kind of way. So we're at this unique place where, you know, you have more and more countries that are recognizing the state of Palestine, and those are the borders of that state when they discuss it. But it's less and less viable as an outcome. Certainly under the current trajectory of the Israeli government.
A lot of people say, well, not justifying the mass starvation that it's causing, but that this war, the current war, there have been many, began October 7th, 2023, with the brutal assault on Israeli citizens as a music festival near the Gaza border. They put the blame entirely on Hamas. Would you please describe the status quo before October 7th? And what do you say to people who say, well, they started the war October 7th?
I mean, this round of fighting began on October 7th, sure.
Yeah.
But the war, if we're going to use that word, has been going on for 100 years. And for Palestinians, it's been an anti-colonial war. For Israelis, it's been, you know, depending on what perspective you take, either a war for independence or security or domination. But this is something that's ongoing. You know, in Gaza alone, we've had rounds of armed fighting every few years ever since Israel withdrew its settlers in 2005. In the West Bank, you know, we were seeing some of the worst violence in many, many decades in the year or two prior to October 7th, 2023.
Uh-huh.
And in fact, my colleagues and I at Dawn were in the beginning of 2023 trying to activate something in the U.S. State Department called the Atrocity Prevention Task Force, because we understood that something, I think a lot of people understood that something was bubbling under the surface and was going to explode, and nobody knew where it was going to come from or what form it would take. But, you know, there are tools and indicators that can help predict these things, and they were off the charts.
Yeah, and ever since 1948, the majority Jews in Israel have fought hard against the right of return for Palestinians who were booted out in 1948 and what they call the Nakba, the catastrophe. I'm guessing you would agree with Sari Bashi, who wrote in the August 2nd New York Times, quote, "It can be difficult to imagine Palestinian refugees returning after so many years and so much violence, but their return would be an opportunity to transform the Israeli system of governance from one supporting an ethno-nationalist state aimed at maintaining Israeli Jewish dominance over Palestinians to a rights-respecting democracy that protects the equality, freedom, and security of all residents." That's the end of that quote. Why shouldn't Jewish Israelis fight hard against that? Would it erase their hold on power? I imagine it would.
Well, a lot of this is about changing power dynamics and who is in power and who dominates who. So, you know, while the right of return for all Jews is enshrined in the Israeli constitution, or what passes for a constitution, and Israeli law, it's expressly forbidden for Palestinians, to the point that, you know, in places that became under the same control, like, you know, Palestinians in East Jerusalem who lived in West Jerusalem before 67 cannot reclaim their land, but Jews in West Jerusalem who lost their homes in East Jerusalem at the same time are able to. Palestinians can have their status, their citizenship, or their residency status in the occupied territories revoked almost at the whims of a military commander or other Israeli officials. And, you know, what Sari writes there, I agree almost entirely with it. But what I would say is that the return of refugees or the right of return of refugees is just one piece. And it's one piece that without it, there is no resolution. There is no moving forward. And this is one of the main sticking points that we saw in Oslo also. You know, there's apparently Arafat agreed to a symbolic return and of about 10,000 Palestinians or Abbas and Olmert in one of the later negotiations. But the point is that without recognizing that right, without acknowledging the catastrophe that Palestinians underwent and that Israel produced for them in 1948 and 1967, and acknowledging that there are millions of Palestinians living as refugees in refugee camps throughout the region, that there's no resolution. And it's not just the refugees in camps in Jordan and Syria and elsewhere. It's most people in the West Bank, most people in Gaza, were displaced at some point from homes that are now inside Israel proper. And, you know, in our plan, we don't try and prescribe what that resolution should look like, but we try very hard to create the conditions where it can be resolved. And I think if you talk to most Palestinians, they'll say that, you know, not everybody would come, and there's, you know, a big disparity in sort of vision. And, you know, I think a lot of people tend to visualize the grandparents' homes as still existing. When many of them do not. And we try and set up to create the conditions where these matters can be resolved democratically and in a way that doesn't, you know, create a new wrong to wrong a right, that doesn't, you know, create a new refugee problem in order to solve an old one.
Hmm. And I would urge any listener who hasn't seen the best documentary Oscar winner, No Other Land, try to go see it. No Other Land. You'll see some destruction of schools, and it's amazing. While the kids are still there, it's remarkable. No other land. There is, you've probably heard about this new plan for the withdrawal of Israel from Gaza and the West Bank, the disarming and disbanding of Hamas, and the creation of a unified Palestinian state. It comes from a high-level conference in New York on July 29th, which assembled representatives of 17 states, the European Union, and the Arab League. The resulting proposal has been called, quote, a comprehensive and actionable framework for the implementation of the two-state solution and the achievement of peace and security for all, end of quote. Well, I have my doubts now about the possibility of a two-state solution. What do you think of this high-level conference and what they came up with?
Well, there's a few very encouraging points and some that are quite discouraging. I'll start with the encouraging,
good,
which is that this all is born of the 2024 advisory opinion of the International Court of Justice, which found that Israel's presence in the occupied territories is illegal and must be brought to an end. And that was followed by a UN General Assembly resolution, which adopted that opinion and said that it should end within a year, which will be this September, next month. Hmm. Now, obviously, that's not happening.
Yeah.
So the fact that there is a revived international movement to take actionable steps, at least, you know, declaratively, to take actionable steps to bring about the two-state solution and more importantly, an end of occupation and apartheid and genocide, is encouraging. I did not see anything really actionable in the in the plan they put out. I wouldn't call it a plan. You know, at best, it's a reiteration, at worst, a regurgitation of the same sort of approaches that we've seen suggested and tried and also just thrown out and not really tried, you know, just put out declaratively for decades now. So I think there's an opportunity to push for a new plan, but I don't see one there quite yet. Certainly one that doesn't address the root causes of the conflict, which, you know, are supremacy and domination and permanent occupation and apartheid.
Indeed. And your book notes that, quote, there's been a dearth of ideas for a positive vision of how to move forward, end of quote. And are you, in your book, offering an idea for how to move forward? Can there be practical steps to transform an undemocratic de facto one-state reality into a democratic rights-respecting regime with equality for all people under its control, with the opportunity to exercise self-determination in one, two, or more states if they choose?
As fantastical as that sounds today, yes, it is possible. And I'll just say that our plan fits into a void that we identified, a lacuna in the thinking about this, which is that you have lots of people thinking about what's wrong and what needs to be stopped. You have lots of people, you know, look at the BDS movement, for instance, the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement, which has been around for 20 years, encouraging the international community to exert all the different types of nonviolent pressure that it can on Israel to end its crimes and fulfill self-determination for the Palestinians or allow that to happen. But, you know, they don't exactly, the BDS tells you the punitive steps. It doesn't say what should happen then.
Uh-huh.
And you have, you know, one state campaign and you have all the two state groups and you have this group, a Land for All, which is advocating for a confederation model, talking about what things could look like. But nobody's saying how to get from point A to point B to bridge those two. And we believe that the lack of articulated thinking there and ideas that have not yet penetrated the mainstream discourse, it robs policymakers and others of the language to even imagine different policies, because it becomes this fantastical exercise of like, oh, everybody's just going to be, you know, live in peace now, or you want us to punish Israel, then what? And the easiest way for me to articulate that is, you know, if BDS movement is successful, and in 15 years, the world recognizes Israel as an apartheid regime and treats it as it did South Africa with isolation and sanctions, what's the off-ramp? What's the positive steps?
Right.
What are the positive steps that Israel can or should take to rejoin the community of nations? And that's what we tried to outline through a 3-year transition plan. that transforms an undemocratic one-state reality into a more democratic one, not because we think that's the best outcome necessarily, but because it's better than the current situation, and because that's the condition in which we believe people can ultimately decide their own futures democratically.
Yeah, people like to have some power over their own future. What a concept. Imagine that. If you just tuned in, Bert Cohen here. The show is Keeping Democracy Alive. We're talking about maybe bringing democracy to Israel-Palestine. Our guest is Michael Schaefer Omer Mann, who's a co-author of a new book, Apartheid to Democracy, a Blueprint for Peace in Israel-Palestine. And as regular listeners know, I'm obsessed with the First World War. Everything changed then. And they only reached an armistice after all sides were exhausted by the mass slaughter that went on for years. Well, this one's been going on a lot longer. As your book says, the blueprint cannot be forced upon Israelis or Palestinians. It requires a level of earnest political will where there is almost none today. The blueprint is predicated on the assumption that it will only become relevant for adoption and implementation as a result of dramatic shifts in Israelis and, relatedly, Palestinians' strategic outlooks. Are we at all close to that now?
You know, I think almost counterintuitively, we're closer today than we were a few years ago.
Huh. Interesting.
And I don't say that because Israelis or Palestinians are imagining a future together right now. I think in that aspect, we're further than we ever have been. Yeah. But there's so much instability and so much lack of clarity about what comes next that creates an opportunity for changing dynamics, for changing attitudes, for people to reconsider. Now, what we meant when we wrote that is that, you know, Israelis have, you know, certain rights, just like Palestinians and everybody else in the world, including the right to self-determination, just as Palestinians do. Now, the question is, how do you attempt to manifest those? What is an acceptable way of achieving self-determination? And for Israelis, that will require redefining or even giving up on Zionism, on the idea that there has to be a Jewish state, with the understanding that in, you know, nearly 80 years, that has never been democratic or respected, or the rights of Palestinians, including the right to self-determination. For Palestinians, what that means is that self-determination may not come in the form of an independent state, the state of Palestine, at least not in the short term. But, you know, the right to self-determination is not the right to national self-determination. And what that means is, as you said a minute ago, the right to choose your own future or to influence the way that decisions are made in deciding your future. And we believe that this is that. This is the way to achieve that. And that type, those types of transformations in people's political ethos and those calculations. You know, there's a lot of writing about this started by an academic called William Zartman about ripeness and conflict resolution, that when people are stuck and they don't see any better option, they will begin to look at other options.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, today it's Israelis who need to reach that point, because they, you know, despite the last 2 years of war and genocide, Israelis live normative lives, more or less.
Yes.
Their economy is doing relatively well and has been for quite some time. They have, you know, with the exception of short periods of war and rockets that you know, cause immense destruction, but nothing compared to what the Israeli army unleashes on others.
Yeah.
They enjoy relative security. So, you know, why would they give that up? And the unfortunate answer is they wouldn't, unless the cost of doing so, unless the cost of maintaining the status quo is high enough that an alternative looks better.
Good point. And I don't see them effectively protecting the status quo and preserving it. You know, we've seen over 60,000 people, Palestinians, have been killed as the devastation has gone on, and a lot more on the brink of starvation. The word famine keeps coming up these days. And it's occurred to me that quite possibly Israel is self-destructing. I wonder, is there any possibility of Israel remaining a Jewish state? Or is that dream over?
Well, let's address this question separately.
Sure.
Is Israel self-destructing? I mean, time will tell. Also, you know, when we say self-destruction, I hope that doesn't mean complete implosion that leads to the end of life for all Israelis, or their expulsion or something like that. But are they moving toward a point where it's easier to envision the world saying no more to their system of governments and right. domination over Palestinians? I hope so. And what a Jewish state means in that type of outcome would have to change. It would have to change. You know, it couldn't mean domination and supremacy and occupation and apartheid. It would have to find some other way, whether it be through cultural autonomy or language or regional autonomy or some other way to maintain a Jewish homeland that is not an exclusive state for Jews, because that is the one of the root causes of where we are today.
And I, as a patriotic American, have always loved and really treasured the separation, the wall of separation between religion and state, and that we've seen countries where they become one, and it's not a pretty picture. Could Jewish Israelis, could Jews around the world interpret what you're saying in your book as a win for the Palestinians?
If everything is a zero-sum game, then sure. You know, nobody gives up privilege voluntarily.
That's true.
So again, like, it's probably not going to be seen as a win for Israel.
Yeah.
But if we look at the current status quo and the status quo of the past 30, 50 years as unsustainable, then the future has to be different. And securing an outcome where everybody enjoys democratic, civil, human rights, and the right to, including the right to self-determination, I think that's a win for everybody. And not necessarily as monolithic blocks of Israelis and Palestinians, but as the humans who live in the region. And, you know, again, we're in a wartime where nationalism is amplified even higher than it is usually, so it's hard to think in those terms even. But ultimately, that's the only way to guarantee equality and justice and liberation for everybody.
Indeed. Now, your book talks about a blueprint. Now, my understanding of a blueprint is, you know, it's literally a blueprint, and it shows what goes where in building a house or a commercial enterprise. What is the blueprint, and what is it not?
Well, it's not a peace plan, because it doesn't tell us how to live together peacefully. What it does is it looks at the structures of occupation and apartheid and methodically gives solutions for what you would do to dismantle them. And that goes from freedom of movement to the separate court systems and legal systems to, you know, security forces and disarmament. And really step by step, including, you know, suggestions of which laws to revoke and which ones to reform and which ones to keep, which ministries can continue, what to do with the separate population registries. We really wanted to just give a very practical policy blueprint for what you would do if the political will existed today to end apartheid and occupation. How would you do it? And again, as I said before, we hope that by doing that, we create a proof of concept that empowers policymakers and others to imagine different policies which might lead to that point.
And your book, like most books, has chapters. And chapter one is international law framework. My question is, wasn't the United Nations set up to provide a framework for avoiding and ending conflicts through international law? What about that?
Sure. And there's a plethora of United Nations right. Security Council resolutions, codifying the Palestinian right to return and that the occupation must end and all these things. You know, international law is there. This is all within international law. We explain. Between me and my co-author, I'm not the lawyer, so I won't try and dive too deep into that. But, you know, why this actually is the solution that would comply most with international law. Now, we know that the law is only as good as the will to enforce it,
right.
And the law is a creation of politicians. So, you know, I wouldn't put all of our faith in the U.S. Congress or the Supreme Court or the Marshall Service, just as I wouldn't put it in the Security Council, which seems to be really unable to do anything on Israel-Palestine, primarily because of the U.S. insistence on backing Israel in every situation.
Yeah, they block lots of good resolutions the United States blocks, which is they have that so much power there. Another chapter is establish a caretaker government. What conditions on the ground will enable creation of a caretaker government? Both sides must agree, yes?
Yes. So again, the place where the blueprint starts is one where there has been sufficient pressure that both sides or sufficient number of people, both lay people and those in power, are willing to try something else. And this gives them the framework for how to do so. Now, we decided to do that through a caretaker government, which mm-hmm. could be described as a transitional government, mm-hmm. but one that removes the current power structures, that creates a unified governance structure for the entire territory, meaning what today is Israel proper and the Palestinian territory of the West Bank, East Jerusalem, and Gaza Strip, and sort of acts as a... Sorry, the best word that's coming to my mind is a Sherpa, but somebody who really guides the process,
uh-huh.
makes sure that it doesn't get derailed, and creates the conditions where decisions can be made democratically and jointly, not necessarily between Israelis and Palestinians as monolithic blocks, but all the different interests and groups that live within those two blocks as well.
Interesting, the use of the word Sherpa. I understand that. I mean, because, Western people who climb Mount Everest couldn't do it without the Sherpas, somebody who knows the territory. If you just tuned in, Bert Cohen here. The show is Keeping Democracy Alive. Our guest is Michael Schaefer Omerman. And the new book that he co-wrote is From Apartheid to Democracy, A Blueprint for Peace in Israel-Palestine. Well, another chapter is the courts. Now, I believe and his far-right government have done away with the independence of the courts. It's now called the High Court of Justice. You're right. What does that system of justice look like now? And what does the blueprint see as a proper role for the courts? How would it look differently implementing the blueprint?
Well, I will answer that, but just before, I want to just add one more point to the previous answer,
sure. Thank
which
you.
Is that, mm-hmm. The caretaker government is locally led. Like, yes, there's international involvement, but as you said, you have to know the local territory. There's no way that an outside force or forces can divine a system of government or transition for people that are not them. So there's this, the caretaker government is made up almost entirely of Palestinians and Israelis and very much locally led. Now with respect to the courts, I think the easiest way to look at this is, building on what I said a minute ago about, the law being written by politicians and only as good as the will to enforce it. This current situation that we have, whether it be of settlements, of forced displacement,
mm-hmm.
of annexation, of genocide, these are all policies that the Israeli Supreme Court has approved.
Right.
That have been adjudicated. And the questions that they don't adjudicate are ones that they don't want to answer. Like, is settlement itself legal under international law? Because, I'm sure that the answer would not be to the liking of Israeli politicians.
Right.
And they keep changing the laws also, including through the nation state law, which I mentioned earlier, that that actually formalizes and constitutionalizes the supremacy of the Jewish right to self-determination over any Palestinian individual or national rights. So what we try and do is, you know, because we're merging, and again, in our theoretical world here, mm-hmm. because we're merging two court systems, but also trying to root out the unjust systems that were essentially built and developed in order to dominate. We need to change that system a little bit so it's more accountable to the principles of equality and justice and liberation and democracy, and not to Zionism and domination. And, you know, again, like, some of this is changing the laws. Some of it is re-educating judges and renaming institutions. Sometimes just renaming an institution is enough to signal that it is going to be different than it was. And that, I think, is the main point. Although it's incredibly detailed, the steps that we lay out, that it needs to be different. That the courts are not, as they exist today, are not set up to protect individual rights or equality or democracy. In fact, quite the opposite.
And Section 8 of your book is titled Restorative Justice, Prisoners and Refugees. And Israel, at least Netanyahu, has claimed that the war that's going on, if you can call it a war, it's a bit different from that, I think, was about freeing the hostages taken by Hamas on October 7th. It's all about freeing the hostages. Of course, Palestinians claim Israel is holding hostage thousands of political prisoners. So this is you envision a transitional justice program. Maybe you can say a little bit more about that.
Yeah, so, you know, this is one of the more contentious issues, yeah. Because it deals with property and it deals with refugees and prisoners. And, you know, a political prisoner to Palestinians is a terrorist to Israelis.
Right.
And, you know, as we mentioned before, the property that a Palestinian refugee dreams of returning to may be occupied and even, you know, sold three times before that by an Israeli family who has no connection to their original displacement. Mm. So there's a few things that we do. One is we acknowledge that all of the literature, all of the studies, all of the scholarship is very clear that transitional justice programs need to be locally led. So we do not prescribe a transitional justice as in such a detailed manner that we do most of the other steps. What we do is we acknowledge, we have the caretaker government acknowledge the rights of refugees. We create a refugee ministry that begins to plan for different sort of menu of policy options that a post-transition government can pursue in order to realize the right of Palestinian refugees, whether it's, you know, through the traditional ways that refugees can resolve their status or in more creative ways. But, you know, it also looks at, you know, there was this Al Jazeera documentary a decade ago, probably, called, I believe it was called The Stolen Books. And it was about how in the aftermath of the 1948 war, Israel collected all the, you know, literally picked up and moved to the National Library, all of the books that they found in abandoned Palestinian houses. And they're all marked as absentee property. There's a list of where they all came from. And yet nobody has been able to reclaim even a book that was seized by Israel in 1948. So, you know, we say that, you know, movable property like books and other things that it's easy to return without creating, without adjudicating anything, should happen immediately. And that includes lands that were confiscated where nobody is living today. So, you know, there are lots of agricultural lands that could be returned to their previous owners without creating any new harms. But that really what needs to happen is, you know, in this transitional moment, to prepare the mechanisms, to put the foundations, whether it's databases of landowners or creating a probate process for challenging land ownership. You know, that this type of thing gets very complicated over generations as, you know, heirs multiply exponentially over, you know, by generation. But the systems need to be in place for policymakers and the people to figure out how to create that transitional justice with regards to, you know, with the understanding that it has to happen in some form or another, in a way that's acceptable to everybody and that complies with international law. With regards to prisoners, you know, one of the most atrocious or egregious practices that Israel has, and one that it took directly from the British occupiers from before 1948, is administrative detention. And that is effectively preventative arrests without trial or charge that can be indefinite, you know, renewed every 6 months, every 3 months, depending on where somebody's from. And so, you know, we look at the categories of prisoners that Israel has created and say, you know, the administrative detainees must be released. Like, if you're going to charge them, otherwise release them immediately. And, you know, as we encourage as inclusive of a political system as possible, you know, similar to what happened in Northern Ireland and to some extent in South Africa, people who were convicted of violent crimes, if they belong to a political party or group that has renounced violence, can also be released. And everything else should be reviewed systematically by independent prosecutors and experts to see if this person should be released. And in most cases, we are talking about political prisoners, whether they've used violence or not. And that is a huge part of the Palestinian consciousness is prisoners. You know, I think one third or one quarter of all Palestinian men since 1967 have been in an Israeli prison. It's everywhere.
Wow.
It's ubiquitous.
And as you were describing administrative detention, somehow it made me think of ICE. I wonder if they got some of their ideas of just grabbing people and moving them without any charges or convictions. Eesh, it does get ugly. I imagine, and we touched on this a little bit before, I've imagined committed Israel supporters, hardcore Zionists, would see your blueprint as a win for the Palestinians and the end of the Jewish state. Would they be wrong? I'm guessing no.
If you're a hardcore Zionist whose idea of national self-determination and security is predicated on the domination over another people, then yes. Yes. But you know, it's not a zero-sum game. They also would benefit from the new system. They would be guaranteed the same rights as Palestinians and that they don't enjoy superiority or domination anymore. Yes, that's a relative loss for them, but you know, it doesn't mean that they lose rights. They only lose privileges and if anything, you know, for instance, you know, the dual legal systems between for Israelis and Palestinians, we're not proposing that Jewish settlers live under military rule like their Palestinian neighbors do. We're suggesting that everybody live under civilian rule, right? We're raising the standards. We're not lowering them. So yes, if the Jewish state is predicated on domination and supremacy carried out through, you know, apartheid and occupation, then yes, that is the end of the Jewish state. But I don't think it needs to be that way.
Well, if Israel and the U.S. are able to completely demolish Gaza and annex the West Bank, which seems not very far off, that, I think, could be claimed as a military victory. Is that not the end? Is it not a genuine victory?
Well, let's start with the West Bank, because annexation is already happening. And there's this, you know, debate that is ongoing for decades about the difference between de jure and de facto annexation. And I, you know, I've long argued that the process of creeping annexation, of slowly extending laws and, you know, increasing methods and institutions of control over the territory and the people who live there, that is the annexation. By the time that we get to a point where someone might make an official declaration of annexation, it'll be way too late to stop it because it'll already have happened. They'll just be naming what's already been done. So in that sense, you know, I don't think annexation would be a victory for anybody. except for those politicians who might, Israeli politicians who might gain a few more votes in the next elections by having being able to say that they did that. With regards to Gaza, you know, I don't think that anything could be a victory in this sense. We've gone so far, in the wrong direction. Genocide is never a victory. Now, if Israel, you know, does what some of its leaders say they want to do, which is to expel the entire Palestinian population,
right,
and take over Gaza and flatten it or whatever
right.
Terminology they use, that obviously would be a human travesty proportions that we haven't, I don't think anybody's prepared for.
Yeah, we haven't seen it in a long time.
That may be why nobody has a response to it. Because we just, you know, it's hard to envision these things happening.
One last question. How is it a blueprint and not a pipe dream?
Well, can it be both?
Yeah, true.
It's a blueprint because, you know, half the book is literally a detailed policy blueprint, plan for how to go about dismantling apartheid and occupation. Now, I wouldn't use the word pipe dream, but I, you know, it's not possible today, but it's a place that it's possible to reach. And by creating that proof of concept, we hope to, as I said earlier, inject vitality into a conversation that has been sorely needed, that will be even more sorely needed after this genocide and this war is over, in order to envision, let alone put into practice, a way forward. And paving that path and just, you know, mapping it out, is it gives people the confidence to consider going on it. You know, if you look at a map, right, and there's not a road there, you don't consider going in that direction.
Uh-huh. That's a good point. Well, it's been fascinating. And as I say, it's a heavy lift. The book is called From Apartheid to Democracy, A Blueprint for Peace in Israel-Palestine. We've been speaking with one of its co-authors, Michael Schaefer Omer Mann, and the other co-author is Leah Whitson. And it's coming out late September, and the publisher again is